Take a minute to support Life of the Law. It's your donation that makes it possible for our team of journalists and scholars to produce and publish the special Inside San Quentin episode you're about to hear. Whether it's $10, $20, $50, or $100, go to lifeofthelaw.org and support award-winning investigative journalism today and for years to come. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, the pleas of the court.
We was segregated here, mm-hmm. but when they put us in them shoes, it was black, white, Mexican, black, white, Mexican. So we had to communicate, you know, and it's from there a narrative began. Oh, he all right. I could talk to him.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. It's been 40 years since inmates at Attica took over the prison to protest the conditions inside the prison. Days later, state police took control. 43 people, including 33 inmates and 10 officers and civilian employees, were killed. If you've listened to our most recent episode, you know we're talking about the fact that more than 2 million people are locked up in our prisons and jails. We invited scholars who have been researching and reporting on this crisis and a man who was incarcerated in California for more than 20 years to join us in the studios of KQED in San Francisco to talk about how we got here and what it would take to make us both a safe society and a humane society. So if you haven't listened to that recent episode, check it out. Immediately after that conversation at KQED, scholars Keramet Ryder, Rebecca McLennan, Ashley Rubin, and Heather Thompson drove to San Quentin State Prison about an hour away to go behind the walls for a discussion with the men locked up, to hear how they're working for the right to be heard and to protest behind the walls in 2017. We'll begin with an introduction by the producer of this episode, Shadeed Wallace Stepter, chair of the San Quentin Society of Professional Journalists.
Okay, so we're going to kick off this SPJ symposium for the Society of Professional Journalists at San Quentin. We are happy to see you distinguished guests here. So my name is Shah. I am the chairman of the SPJ San Quentin. And one of the things we're going to do is go around and introduce ourselves. I've been incarcerated for the last 17 years. I am a journalist and TV production coordinator for San Quentin TV in the San Quentin Prison Report. And with that being said, it is fantastic to have you guys here. I'm glad you guys made it. And I look forward to a spirited and rich discussion. So I'm going to turn it over to my guy.
Hello. Thank you for coming. I'm Noel Scott. I write for the newspaper, and I work here at San Quentin Prison Report.
Hello, I'm Emil. Excited to have you here. I'm the secretary for SPJ and the co-founder of Prison Renaissance.
I'm Sam Hearns. I work for SQ News, and I'm a member of SPJ.
I'm Rasan Thomas. I work for San Quentin News, co-founder of Prison Renaissance, co-chairman for the Society of Professional Journalists, contributing writer for the Marshall Project, and some other stuff.
Stop
You're a busy man.
My name is Forrest Jones. I write for the San Quentin newspaper, and I'm a member of SPJ.
I'm Juan Haynes. I'm senior editor for San Quentin News and an SPJ member.
I'm Marcus Henderson. I'm the Journalism Guild chairman for San Quentin News.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sawyer, and I'm the associate editor for San Quentin News.
I'm Arnulfo Garcia, and executive editor for San Quentin News.
My name is Ruben, and I'm just an invitee. 42 years in prison, 26 years in Pelican Bay, and here to enjoy this program.
I'm Wayne Bay Johnson, 22 years in Pelican Bay SHU. I'm not here as a visitor.
Hi, I'm Luke. I am a reporter with the KALW radio. I really enjoy it, and I really appreciate you guys being here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lewis Scott. I'm a reporter for KALW as well, and it's nice to see you all.
Brian Acey, San Quentin Prison Report.
Erlon Woods, co-host of a podcast called Ear Hustle.
Nancy Mullane, Life of the Law executive producer.
So with that being said, if you guys could introduce yourselves, and we will start with Keramet.
So I'm Keramet Ryder. It's a total honor and thrill to be back, weirdly, to say that about San Quentin. I taught in the Prison University Project for 5 years before I finished my PhD at Berkeley. So I know Sam, but I think that's the only familiar face. And I now am a professor at UC Irvine. I teach criminology and law there. And just this fall, I published the book 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary, which I think many of you probably know more about than I do, even. And the press ran a special paperback print run that's supposed to be slowly making its way into prison. And you can, Prison Legal News ran an ad, so you can write and ask for a paperback if you want it directly. They're free. They're supposed to be printing a few more. I think they ran out of the first run. But if you're interested, I've started to get a few letters from guys who've read it, because I thought you all should be the first to hear it. So that's my background.
Thanks, Keramet. My name's Rebecca McLennan, and thank you so much for inviting us to meet with you and to talk with you. I'm a professor of history at UC Berkeley, and I published a book a few years ago on the crisis of imprisonment, protest politics, and the making of the American penal state. It's a history of the invention of incarceration and of the prison system and the various kinds of crises that it was subject to in the course of the 19th century and the kind of the role of social movements changing incarceration. I teach a history of crime, punishment, and power at Berkeley to undergraduates. It's a pretty popular undergraduate class. I've been doing that for, I think actually it's my 25th year teaching this class, but not at Berkeley. I've taught it bunch of different places, and I'm just really thrilled to be here and to discuss some of these issues. Thanks.
So thank you for bringing us here. I'm really glad to meet all of you. I'm Heather Thompson, and I come to you via Detroit. I am a professor at the University of Michigan, although also come to you from Philadelphia because I've just moved back to Detroit where I'm from. And I wrote the book Blood in the Water, which is about the Attica prison uprising. And I also teach lots of courses on prison, on policy, and I do work in D.C. on trying to affect change within the system. And I don't know as much about California as I'm sure I should. So I'm really glad to be here to have this conversation and to learn from all of you. So thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Ashley Rubin. Thank you very much for having us here. This is a great opportunity. I volunteered for Prison University Project for about 6 months when I was in grad school. I'm currently an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto, and I just started that about 6 months ago. Before that, I was in Florida for 3 years working in a criminology department. I don't yet have my book, but I'm currently working on a book on Eastern State Penitentiary, which was one of the more kind of important early prisons that kind of set the tone for later on, but at the same time didn't become as influential as other prisons at the time. So as you might know, it used a system of solitary confinement long term, but it wasn't like modern supermaxes. It, in a sense, was a lot nicer than modern supermaxes, but many things are. So I'm looking at why this prison alone retained the system of long-term solitary confinement in the 19th century. So that's me.
So I think we can dive right into the discussion. Mr. D. Weaver, you were looking at me. You want to kick it off?
No, I was just scratching my head.
Okay. So in terms of with the first topic, right, we're talking about protest in prison. And so I think one of the things that I'm really interested about, Ms. Thompson, I read the book, and I thought the book was superb. And we've had an opportunity to read all of you guys' work, and I think you guys are, like, really doing some great stuff. So in terms of with the blood in the water, right, so what are some of the lessons that you think that the United States prison system in general should be taken away from that incident?
Okay, so the project was a really long-term project. It took me 13 years to write a comprehensive accounting of what went down at Attica in 1971, when 1,300 men essentially took over D-Yard and began a four-day and four-night negotiation with the state of New York to improve conditions on the inside. And it's a really historic event. It's notable because of the incredible unity in the yard. It's notable because of the way in in which the world watched as this went on for these 4 days and nights. The media was there, the television cameras were there, and it was really remarkable because for one of the first times, the entire nation could get a glimpse of what really goes on inside, thanks to the brothers inside, because they really shone the light. But it's also notable because the state of New York then retook the prison on the fifth day with extraordinary force and killed 39 men, guards and prisoners alike, and shot 128 men extremely severely, some of them 6, 7, 8 bullet wounds. And that was really the beginning of the horror, because then these men were tortured for days and weeks and months, and then they were indicted for 62 men were indicted for what had gone down there, even though it was state troopers that were responsible for all of the deaths on the day of the retaking and all of the shooting. And so my book sought to both rescue that rebellion and to ask questions about struggles for prisoner rights, but it was also me trying to figure out how, what happened, right? How could it be that all the trauma that happened that day, the fifth day, which was September 13th, 1971, how could it be that not one single member of law enforcement ever saw the inside of a courtroom?
Hello, Emil, again. And this question is for everyone who is so in Blood in the Water. It seems to highlight this very strange contradiction where, like, a person in society is put in prison for doing things the wrong way, and once he's in prison and tries to do things the right way, they're punished and like crushed for it, right? I find that very striking and very strange, and I wonder what your thoughts are on that contradiction. That's my question.
Just on Attica, and then I'll shut up about it. I will say one of the most striking things about that story, and I think you're hitting on it, is that time and time again, when you read the history of Attica, you are struck by who this idea of who the bad guys are and who the good guys are is constantly inverted, right? Because it's the guys inside are doing the right thing constantly. And even during this rebellion, they're always doing the right thing. And of course, it's the people who we would think are doing the right thing who are doing all the wrong things. And it, you're right. It's just like this weird inversion in tension. And that's exactly why it's important to tell, because it's not what people would assume or think.
Sure. Thank you. So thank you for that question. I would say that that's kind of like a general theme within the criminal justice system. Excuse me. And I'm sure you guys are well aware of this. Like, so much of criminal justice policy is supposed to be common sense, but when you actually look at it, it really doesn't make common sense.
And of course, there are theorists and philosophers like Michel Foucault, who I'm sure many of you guys have read, who argue that actually prisons are, in a sense, set up to fail. They're set up to essentially reproduce what he calls delinquency, or what we can think of as rule breaking. That they're kind of a self-perpetuating machine. And so that whenever we talk about prisons, do they fail or succeed, we always need to ask, what are we asking them to do? And that he, you know, spent a lot of time, a good part of his career, documenting how at least the French prison system, and he actually mentions Attica in that first chapter, the Attica Rebellion, exactly, 1972, he talks about it, that prisons are generating people and behaviours that need to be, in the eyes of the law, need to be put under surveillance and need to be disciplined, that it's this kind of self-reproducing order. And so that's pretty grim, you know, take on what prisons were set up to do, that this is not, they're not failing, they're succeeding in that way, which is what's highly problematic about the prison.
That theory aside, practically today, I think we have institutions that have a big investment in continuing to exist, right? I mean, there are all kinds of social investments in running these kinds of prison systems in terms of the people working here and the industries involved, right? I mean, I'm preaching to the choir. But once you have a system like that in which so many things are, so many lives are invested in maintaining that system, then it makes a lot of sense that the system needs the undisciplined people or the problems in order to continue to exist. And so there's not the right incentives in place to create rehabilitation or to make the system less necessary.
I think that's a good point, especially when it comes to like observing things to a T, because even when you do observe things to a T, you know, if that was the case, there would be no need for protest. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And different strategies we can use to actually get things that we actually are entitled to. So like another question I want to ask, and this is really for everyone though, right? Like, what are some of the lasting effects from, you know, like a popular protest like or uprising that happened in Attica. What effect has this had on the American criminal justice system, like overall?
I think in terms of Attica, I mean, I think that it's really ironic. Like on the one hand, this was one of the most incredible human rights struggles of the entire 20th century. I mean, you've never seen this kind of, you know, unity and clarity about what people needed. And by the way, what people were asking for was pretty basic, right? I mean, people are, you know, the most controversial thing was probably having some rational parole rules, because in Attica, if you got parole, you needed to write to an employer outside of the prison. And it wasn't until they hired you could get out. But of course, the phone book was outdated and nobody got a job that way. So that was like the most controversial thing probably on the list was we didn't want to reform the parole rules. So basic stuff, right? So on the one hand, it was tremendously successful. In some respects, New York State prison system was one of the more liberal and humane of a lot of the prison systems, and that's because of the legacy of Attica, right? So it had improvements in visiting rules, it had improvements to medical care, it had improvements to all kinds, actually a lot of things. So that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, because the state of New York took it with such force, and the carnage was so massive, and because the rest of the world, the rest of the nation, hears a really different story about what went down, right? I mean, they are literally told, the rest of the nation is told that the hostages that were killed by the state bullets were killed by prisoners. Stood out right in front of the prison, lied. It went out on the front page of the New York Times, front page of the LA Times, every small town newspaper in between. So one of the tragic things about that particular protest was that they lost the narrative because they didn't get to tell the story themselves. And the state got to tell it, that the rest of the nation decided the response should be to get more punitive. Take away stuff. Take away parole altogether, you know? So I think one of the issues about protests that is so interesting is protests are effective, but they can also backlash, right? And to talk about what is that dynamic and how to kind of make sure that the backlash doesn't follow and something positive happens. It's tough.
And I think In thinking about the response to protests, I often think of two different responses. There's the kind of public response and this question of whether you get a tough on crime response and the kinds of sentencing and the things that are criminalized outside of prison. But there's the internal response that's so important also. And I think there, as you're suggesting, over and over again, there has been an internal response in terms of conditions of making things, I think, often superficially better. I think many of the things that prisoners were complaining about in the 70s in prisons in terms of, like, just literally not having adequate toilet paper or never having access to families, in some ways there are rules that now govern those that I think are generally applied. Even at Pelican Bay, the kinds of abuses that were happening when it first opened in the 80s aren't happening in the same way, or at least they're not coming out to the same degree. But you get these prison systems that are better and better at controlling it, whether it's the cellular model or whether it's one of the really important reactions, I think, to Attica and all of the protests that were happening around the nation were long-term lockdowns that became supermaxes. And the supermaxes look really constitutional in all kinds of ways. You do not see the physical harm of that institution, and so they have been really hard to resist in terms of litigation or asserting constitutional rights against them. And yet,
and you should also know, this is to this point, this is kind of interesting, or at least it was interesting to me when I realized it doing the research on Attica. So it's actually right after Attica that the state of New York, the commissioner of corrections, starts calling for what he calls a maxi facility. And this is the first time that was really in the lingo. And what he wants to do, what he means by it, is he wants to lock up everybody who he thinks are the black militant troublemakers. That's the way he defines it, right? So the maxi is going to lock up the Black Panthers, and it's going to lock up anybody who he thinks was agitating the rebellion. Well, he gets shut down. Like, they're not going to do a maxi just for political militants. But of course, in the long run, that's exactly what ends up happening in the system. And it's called the supermax, and it's in a lot of different states. But the origins of that idea that you need a separate facility for certain people that are, the you know, defined in a certain way, that all goes right back to that moment. And that's why, you know, we're actually, I think, really interested to hear what you all think about this very question, particularly being in California and after, you know, the hunger strike and so forth. So
who wants to
Kevin Sawyer.
I mean, I write for the newspaper, and that's a form of protest, but it's a little more subtle. But I've written in other publications. One of them is last year, the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons. It's published by the University of Ottawa, Canada. But there's a lot of heat coming out of that journal. And that, to me, is a form of protest, but I'm really interested in what you think.
So I'm Ashley Rubin again. If I can answer, one of the things that we're concerned about as academics is we don't want to speak on behalf of incarcerated people and say, like, you know, this is what we think is going on. So this is an issue for me. A lot of the research on resistance, people interpret something and say, like, this is what this prisoner is thinking. This is what they're trying to do. And I'm thinking, did you talk to them? Did you ask them that? And, like, it's not our place to read into that. And I have interpretations about what counts as resistance and what doesn't, but one of the things that I think we're all really interested in is what you guys think about that. But to go ahead and answer your question, I think anything that you do and you have a political motivation in it and you see it as resistance, that to me is resistance.
Okay, so my name is Juan Haynes, and the whole purpose of protest is to bring about some change. And we've been protesting since we put up walls, one way or the other. And for us in prison, the protest, the purpose of protest typically is to bring some sort of dignity or humanity to how we're living. However effective these protests are, it's all dependent upon who's hearing it.
Well, that's also why, so it's very interesting that Attica is always called the Attica Riot. And if you notice on my book, that's not what I call it. I call it the Attica Uprising or the Attica Rebellion, because I want to be really, really clear that that did not happen because people just got too mad or wanted to throw a tantrum or wanted to erupt in violence, that there was some really deep fundamental desires and needs that were behind what happened on those 4 days. And in turn, I mean, so not only do I see that what they're calling a riot as a rebellion, but the very fact that we keep calling a riot in some respects dismisses it. In some respects, it connotes a bunch of crazy people running around just breaking stuff and harming people, right? It does not, when you say rebellion, it says we got a purpose here.
And this is Shaw again. I think this is a perfect segue to actually bring up the topic of the Pelican Bay hunger strike. So I want to ask one of the brothers, either Brother Wayne Bay or Brother G2, if you brothers can give us a little bit of insight on some of the things that actually led to that and how that got going.
My name is Reuben Williams. I spent 26 years in Pelican Bay, and I was in dead middle of the hunger strike. And a lot of the things that we were fighting for to begin with wasn't going to benefit us anyway. It was going to basically benefit most of the guys in general population.
What were some of those issues?
Like different types of jobs, positions, things like you guys got going here now, media availability, the ability to get to computers, which we have in the law libraries in every single cell, just little things like that. So we stood and we did what we had to do.
So how long did it last from start to finish?
From start to finish, 62 days. But before that, it went on for about 3-4 weeks. I think what made it real a big issue is that they began to see the things that we were complaining about all the time were actually real. Mm-hmm. You see, you know, we were telling people things were taking place. No, they're not doing nothing like that. Why would they do that? And when they finally got a chance to see it, they said, oh, my God, this is real. They're really doing this to these guys.
How did they see it?
Well, they started to have tours. I had a visit from the United Nations representative for isolation, and they came and they talked, and a couple of these individuals had been POWs themselves. So they already have an understanding of what isolation was about. That was the ending, pretty much the beginning of the end for that particular issue. I was one of the first ones who was to benefit from the lawsuit, and 2015, I was released to Ironwood State Prison Mainline to do a year in the level 3 and then to be come on to a level 2 here at San Quentin State Prison.
Real quick, let me ask Wayne Bay if there's anything you
want to add. Wayne Bay Johnson, I'm one of the 10 plaintiffs. Putting it in context, there's a psychological thing to all this because you have to remember that prior to the hunger strikes, we wasn't cordial with each other. We all had history with each other in terms of violence. So trying to bring us together for the hunger strike wasn't easy. Some protests say, no, I'm not going to get with them. You know, you had this going on. But then after a while, we started talking to each other rather than talking at each other. And you have to realize, too, that the first two that brought it was two individuals, they was white. And certain people said, no, I'm not with that. But then we seen that if we come together, we can make things happen. So after a while, we started communicating, you know. So the list went from five core demands to 40. And then after that, they said, well, we might as well take it all away. And then eventually, we started winning in the courts, because we got the judges started listening to us, along with the people started listening to us, too. Like, I started writing a bunch of articles in the Bayview and everywhere else. And people start you know, commenting on it. And, I mean, it just went viral, you know? Like you say, I got the hold in October of 2014. I was sent on a step down to New Folsom. I'm still acclimating, and it's mind-boggling to me. But I think that we accomplished a whole lot, because it changed the whole complexion, not only in Pelican Bay, but all across the nation. All the shoes, all the MAC facilities start listening.
Can I ask, what do you think made that difference? What do you think brought people together that wouldn't have stood together before and did this? Like, what was it that did it?
Well, the breakthrough moment was, I think, the clear minds came online. They said, look, man, it ain't about you, it ain't about me, it's about all of us, you know? And that's what started, because like some of the guys that, like the majority of people they said was gangs. Like some of these cats I've been knowing 40 years. You know, I was in youth authority with some of them. So I understood that it wasn't about race, it was about politics. You know, and once you get through the politics, everything else comes on, you know, and that's what happened.
Yeah, Arnulfo. Yeah, I can identify what you guys are talking about. I was 18 years old, 1970, when I came to prison. The most I ever been in prison in the whole was 3 years, though, and from 72 to 75, right? But the politics through the years, the question that I have for you, you know, like I heard you say that, you know, when you guys were able to set that politics aside, and you started communicating with each other, what was that feeling like? And then also, when you came out and you've seen the stuff that's going on the yards now, what do you think with the communication there and how they could change things the way they are going on the mainline now?
Reuben Williams, to answer your question on what I think you're asking about, as I said, I lived in a pod, the only black for 9 years, and I lived around two of the top Mexicans and one of the top whites. And we had come to the conclusion that if they open these doors and you don't come this way, I won't come that way. Because nobody wanted to continue having to look at behind their back. And when I came to the main line, I think what surprised me more than that is that I had drank this Kool-Aid that the young black men were doing nothing but out here just killing themselves. But what I saw at Ironwood really hit me. Brothers was walking around with books and talking like they had just graduated from Yale. and then they hitting me up for all of this prison history, and I'm telling them, this ain't the nonsense you need to hear, man.
To answer your question in one word, communication. When they forced us to live right next door to each other, so like he said before, Wayne Bay, we was segregated here. But when they put us in them shoes, it was black, white, Mexican, black, white, Mexican. And only eight cells in each pod. So we had to communicate, you know, and it's from there, a narrative began. That's how I think the barriers start. Oh, he all right. Oh, he sit down and take a crap, you know, or whatever, you know, and I could talk to him. In fact, one of my best friends was a neo-Nazi. Who would think? You know what I mean? We used to talk all day, every day.
Right.
You know, you say, what you talk about? Talk about, I mean, life. He used to talk about his kids, you know? I'm not mad at him because he don't like me. I mean, he not, I mean, he don't mean anything to me, you know? and it's all about communication.
Right.
So I got Rasan and I got Kevin, but before we get to you guys, I want to ask Keramid, as I understand it, you wrote something on the Pelican Bay hunger strike. So how, in terms of the research that you did, what do you take away from what you just heard? And was there comparisons? Is there contrast or?
Well, one thing I'll say is that I've been working on solitary confinement issues and reform since 2000, and I never imagined I would see the kind of change we've seen in California in the last 2 years. And what you guys accomplished from Inside the Shoe is phenomenal. I mean, it's, and when you study the history of resistance, to know what you were able to do in terms of organizing people and the discipline you revealed is incredible. And I feel, as someone who's been working on and advocating on these issues for so long, I feel some shame that it took you guys inside to do that, right? I mean, the advocates on the outside utterly failed you again and again. So I would start there. And I think it's because of that, because it made such a change, I think it's really important for people to understand and try to make sense of and think about. And I think we're all trying to figure out how did you do it? Why were people able to hear it? Why did those first concessions happen? And I think you're absolutely right. Those first few concessions were really important to kind of beginning a spiral. One of the things I've said about it is I think that from a kind of legal perspective, the ways in which from inside the shoe you were asking the state to just follow their own rules was incredibly powerful on the outside, because the state was saying you guys were outside of the law, right? They were saying you were monsters who deserve nothing. And you came to the state and said, all we want is for you to follow really basic rules that there's no dispute over. And I think that was powerful to people on the outside. I give you a ton of credit. And one thing I would say is that sort of legal understanding and the way it helped people rethink it. I'll also say, in going around and talking about Pelican Bay and the hunger strikes, I did one of my first talks on my book that came out in October right after the elections. And a bookstore I was at said, if the guys in Pelican Bay can organize, we can too. And I've heard that again and again. So you're inspiring people all over the country to say, you know, times might be tough, we might be sad, but you guys did it.
Yeah, I got a question for the shoe guys and Caramel. To the shoe guys, you guys are mentally strong, so it probably didn't affect you. You probably didn't need it. But I was just curious. They say solitary confinement affects your mental health. So when they kicked you out to the level threes or whatever that process was there a check-in on your mental health, or were you just on your own? That's the question to you guys.
Wayne Bay Johnson, when I came out to shoe, like I said, I went to a New Folsom, and the first thing they had me to do was to see a psychiatrist. And my question to the psychiatrist, where was you when I needed you? You know, right. I'm good.
Right.
My name is Reuben Williams. When I hit the main line in Ironwood, I saw no one. They asked no questions.
And then the comment, my question is, in developing your expertise on shoe issues and stuff like that, what access did you have to incarcerated Americans to find out, to get their input, to develop your expertise? My second question that developed now is how important it is to have a mental health check-in with somebody that's been in isolation for decades.
I'll start with isolation. I think the resilience you guys have displayed is incredible and creates a challenge for all these people who are trying to document the really horrendous psychological consequences of spending time in isolation. That you've survived at all is incredible. But from the people I've talked to, the kinds of experiences you had stay with you forever, and you make it through and you come out here and you survive. But at least everyone I've talked to talks about all kinds of challenges you talked about it, having a cellmate, right? And the kinds of human interaction you have to get used to, and the fact that you're able to control your space in that cell, and you lose so much control when you come out, and that's a really, I can't imagine adjusting to that. So I think, giving people a space at least to talk about it. I'm glad you two are here and maybe can talk about it together. But I think, even though people don't necessarily, when they survive, it's not immediately obvious. I've talked to lots of people who've been in isolation. I would never pick them out on the street and know it. But when you really get down and talk to them, I think the psychological consequences are incredibly long-lasting and incredibly hard to grapple with. And we've been running a mass experiment for 40 years in this country around long-term isolation, and nobody knows the right way to deal with it. And I think it's not something people have even begun to think about, because we're just beginning, in states like California, to say, can we unwind?
Kevin Sawyer again. So
You know, for years I read about what was going on in Pelican Bay, but the only way I was able to get the information was through publications like California Prison Focus and Bayview. But I was always incensed by the fact that there were two classes of prisoners, those who just didn't care because it wasn't their problem, and then those who kind of thought like me. But with that said, you guys haven't touched on how the races came together. Can you talk a little bit about the plan to end racial hostilities? Because I know that's what kind of ultimately led to the hunger strike.
Like I said, the stronger heads came together, right? Everybody wasn't in agreement. But then, you know, some was, like the brother said, Brother G2, some was willing to die, you know? And I think I was one of them. If that nurse hadn't came to my cell and told me that if I didn't, I told her, well, I'm going to come off Sunday. She said, you won't be alive Sunday. Because I couldn't even stand up. I was gone. But if it took that to get out this shoe, then so be it.
Ruben, to answer your question, from my perspective, I think that what you have is a bunch of guys who have gotten older and mature and were sick and tired of the childish behavior patterns that we have been carrying on for years for reasons that nobody could tell you what was today. Grown men just matured and decided that this was the best thing for us.
Do y'all feel like that's some good news for the future of life inside, that can happen, that these barriers can break down and that the men can stand together more? Because I know it was certainly in the 80s and the 90s, I mean, a lot of warfare, a lot of tensions, and sounds like there's a lot of hope in your story, too. And I wonder if people, when you come in the mainland, do they want to hear this story? Do they want to hear about that hope?
I know, I feel the guys that work in here, and I see the guys in here that I don't know personally, but I know what they do. And I don't see them lending themselves to that type of chaos. So if you're not lending yourself to chaos, then you're probably doing something to prevent it. Mm-hmm. So I think that there isn't a mindset here that would allow that type of thing to take place mm-hmm. in that larger scale. We're talking about something that hit, and as you remember, it lasted for 10, 15 years, mm-hmm. you know. And so finally somebody, cooler heads prevailed. And like I said, we began to mature. And at that same time, the system out here was changing. With the individuals you have, they're able to be at the forefront a lot of this stuff before it takes place.
But when you think back on that, I promise I'll stop asking questions, but I'm just so interested in this because, you know, like, what do you think happens between sort of between the 70s and then the 80s and the 90s? Like, why was that period so much like that?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with not only just the prisons. It had to do with what was taking place on the outside.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
It was the height in the early 70s. It was the height of the Black Liberation Movement. Yep. Where there was shootouts with police on the street corners. And it was going up all over the place. Mm-hmm. People were thinking about change, mm-hmm. and they were willing to go to the greatest depths to get it.
Well, that part, I feel like on the outside, I think we feel like we do understand that part pretty well because of those connections. But what about then when it all kind of
when it blows up and yeah. then you find yourself? So let's say, for instance, you get arrested, you end up in prison, you come here,
yeah.
then this place destroys your independent spirit.
Yeah.
And you, whether you believe it or not, I know I'm psychologically affected from the time I spent in SHU, and I know it.
Yeah. One thing I want to say is I really appreciate that remark because I do think that while it's true that we have not paid anywhere near enough attention to solitary on the outside, you know, it's amazing how much it's become normalized that people spend that are getting these sentences for so long. I mean, the fact that that's even remotely normal now, part of our job on the outside is to remind people how abnormal that is, right? That you know, you talk to young people today on the outside, and if they hear someone gets a 10-year sentence, that seems light to them. But if you look internationally or you look historically, 10 years, I mean, that's a decade of somebody's life. I mean, that's not light, but somehow in the popular mind, that sounds like that's easy, you know. so then 40 years sounds normal. And again, that comes down to a lot of what we have to do on the outside, because that's about reminding people what is normal and what is not, because it you know, it's not only not normal, it's actually really recent. You know, in the scheme of American history, it's really, really recent. And we're an international outlier. Nobody's doing this.
And I do think, at least here, Keith Whatley and Uncommon Law are doing incredible work to raise awareness around the parole board issues in the state. And really, you know, I see events all the time at Berkeley at the law school, and I think it's way too slow. But I think there's really, there's momentum for change in the state around those issues, and people are getting educated more than they used to be even 3 or 4 years ago, if that's at all encouraging.
Kind of piggybacking on what Heather said and something that you said that kind of has a question in my mind, this idea that in the American mind, like, you know, 40 years is normal and 10 years is light. And like you said, like, I don't know whether you said the 1900s or the 1800s, but it was like they thought, it was like, man, this is barbaric. Like, we shouldn't do this, right? And people are bringing out information now that are saying all the reasons why we shouldn't do this, right? And so, like, all these things are public knowledge, and like, you know, people in the free world are out there saying these things, but it does not seem to be penetrating. So my question is, what do you think is missing from the narrative, given that this seems to be an issue of narratives, right? And so it's a narrative and a counter-narrative, and this counter-narrative that we're bringing that are, like, actually based on, like, facts and, like, science and, like, all kind of shit, right, are not penetrating. So what do you think is missing?
But bear in mind, and this is to actually make us feel a little bit less panicked about how deeply it's penetrating. I mean, I think every one of us can tell you that even, I mean, I started working on my book in 2003, 2004, and when I would talk about these issues with people on the outside, it was like, what are you talking about? What? Solitary? What? Long-term sentences? People didn't even know what determinate sentences were, or indeterminate. Or, I mean, that kind of discussion that we've been having in the public is relatively, and I say relatively, recent. And, you know, it was only in 2015 that there was real kind of national discussion that maybe we need to roll back some of these sentences, or that we needed to start looking at solitary. I mean, I'm not sure, but just lay people, you know, just people who wouldn't know any different. And it, so in that sense, there's been kind of remarkable penetration in a very short period of time, believe it or not. I mean, I know it's hard to see it that way, but I mean, I can just tell you, like, we would be talking about this, what, 5 years ago, and it was like we were speaking Greek out there. Really? So that's actually a good thing.
And I also think mass culture is beginning to take note. And on the radio show earlier this morning, we talked a little bit about shows like Orange is the New Black, which for all its faults, nonetheless has a kind of sense of deep social empathy and brings individual stories and humanizing stories, gives names and stories to faces of the incarcerated, albeit in a fictional prison, a fictional universe. And the fact that that's on mainstream American television, which I think was just not possible 10 years ago, let alone 15 or 20 years ago, that this is a sort of empathetic portrait, and we need more of that kind of empathetic. You were sort of gesturing towards this before about, you know, tackling some of the stereotypes that basically are used to justify lock them up and throw away the key type carceral policies, and to sort of break through with stories of real and imagined human beings who are incarcerated with their stories. And that's beginning to happen in mass culture, and I think we need to do a lot more of it, and that's something that we can partner up between inside and outside, help to provide platforms for that. That seems to be a really important connection to kind of, you know, ram some holes through the wall, basically.
Thank you. So, Ashley, again, I would say social media is also something that's increasingly important, and I would use the example of police shootings of Black people. This is something that has been happening since really the beginning of the police. There's a great article, well-done article, I should say, about police shootings in New Orleans in the 1910s. And this is something that's been happening. It's in the same way. It's the person's back is turned to the person. You have the autopsy reports, and the autopsy coroner person is just signing off on it on, you know, accidental, or the person was, you know, resisting arrest or something like that. And so this is something that we know has been going on for so long, but now we're getting it on film because people have their flip phones and now their iPhones, and they're able to record it, and people are able to see this happening. And so it's not just this thing that like academics are saying or conspiracy theorists are saying. You could actually see it happening. And some people are still saying like, oh, well, you can't fully understand what's happening on this video. You know, like it might be taken out of context. So people are, yeah, so people are still saying that. But like a lot of people are also saying, wait a minute. I don't know if you guys saw a while ago, there's some kids in a pool and this young black woman was in a bikini and like this police was like roughing her up. And like, and you see these white people standing around and nothing's happening. So like being able to see those images, I think that is also really powerful. It's not somebody even like telling the story, it's you can actually see it happening. And one of the problems with prison is that you don't get to see it. And one of the advantages of the court cases was being able to see pictures of the bad beds in the cafeterias and the, or not the cafeteria, sorry, the gymnasiums, and getting to see those images. And we use those in our lectures and show people like, this is what the living conditions are like in California prisons, and getting people to see that. I think images are really important. So like, I think word, narrative, that's really important, but increasingly like images and using social media are also really important in getting it out there.
Inside San Quentin, The Right to be Heard in Protest was produced by Shadid Wallace-Stepter, a reporter with the San Quentin Prison Report and chair of the San Quentin chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, and Life of the Law's senior producer, Tony Gannon. We want to thank Rebecca McLennan, Keramet Ryder, Ashley Rubin, and Heather Thompson, and the men for joining us for this special Inside San Quentin episode. You can find links to all of their books and articles on our website, lifeofthelaw.org. Heather Thompson's tremendous book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, recently was awarded the 2017 Pulitzer Prize. We also want to thank Emile DeWeaver, Rasan Thomas of Prison Renaissance, Larry Schneider, Lieutenant Sam Robinson, and Ron Davis, Warden of San Quentin State Prison, for making this episode possible. Visit our website, lifeofthelaw.org, to see photos of the discussion inside San Quentin and read more about the day. Our post-production editors are Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel and Rachel Kane. Our music was composed by Ian Koss and David Jassy. Seal Muller was our engineer. If you're curious about the law and like binge listening, tune into Life of the Law on iTunes. There are more than 100 amazing episodes about people and the law. Take a few minutes to post your review, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Each time we publish a new episode, we send everyone who's subscribed to our newsletter a behind-the-scenes look at Life of the Law, including notes from our reporters and our listeners. We're a nonprofit project of the Tide Center, and we're part of the Panoply Network of Podcasts. You can also find Life of the Law on PRX, Public Radio Exchange. We're funded by the Law and Society Association, the National Science Foundation, and by you. Visit our website, lifeofthelaw.org, and make a very much appreciated donation to help pay for the direct costs of producing our episodes. We also want to welcome Jessica McKellar to Life of the Law's Advisory Board. You can read more about Jessica in our newsletter, which you can read and sign up for on our website, lifeofthelaw.org. Next on Life of the Law.
The law is anything but black and white. I'm not a doctor who can look at an x-ray and see that the bone is broken. Pretty easy to do that, but we don't have x-rays in the practice of law. What we have is a lot of subjectivity.
That's next on Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Thanks for listening.